Great.
Okay. Today is March 9th, Wednesday, 2011. This is Aaron Cusick. I'm here in the Durham County Public Library speaking with Caitlin Breedlove, who is the co-director of Southerners on New Ground. We'll be talking about her involvement in LGBT and social activism in North Carolina. So Caitlin, thank you for agreeing to meet with me. I'd like to start by asking a few questions just to get some background information. So could you tell me about your early life, like where you grew up, where you're from, your family?
Sure. So I grew up primarily in Madison, Wisconsin, although I've now been in the South my whole adult life. My parents have both been in social justice work. It's pretty much a way of life in that branch of my family. My mother was born in Europe and came here later in her childhood and life. So my family has both Eastern European and Central European immigrant roots, which definitely influenced some of my political thinking as a second generation immigrant. My early life, I definitely think I often tell the story that I was very politicized by a lot of things in my early life. I grew up with fairly radical parents in a pretty liberal town. My mom used to refer to Madison as an armchair liberal town, although some people listening to this interview might think that's interesting given recent events in Madison, Wisconsin. If someone would have asked me if there would have been this kind of uprising in Wisconsin or in Madison, I would have said absolutely not 6 months ago. But, you know, there's always opportunities to eat humble pie about things. Madison traditionally has been very controlled by sort of armchair liberal politics, you know, where folks would be like, we recycle, therefore, you know, we are aimed towards social justice. So I learned a lot about disability rights work, about feminism, about prison systems as a young person. And another thing that definitely shaped, a couple things shaped my early life, definitely being an immigrant and going back and forth between Central and Eastern Europe and the U.S. when I was a kid, whenever we had money to go, was a very life-changing experience.
And what time period would that have been?
Well, it was starting when I was very small and throughout my whole life, but when I was a teenager, I went back and lived. I lived in Prague when I was 15 and 16, and through my teenage years specifically, being with my family, developing my language skills, which for folks who are second-generation immigrants, it makes a really big difference when you can talk to your family. You know, it's one of the huge painful things about immigration when people lose their ability to talk to their own grandparents or great-grandparents. So a couple things were shaping for that. One thing that I often haven't talked about earlier was that my great-aunt, who was like my great-grandmother, she and her partner survived the Holocaust as lesbians in Germany. So that was a very profoundly changing and affecting
And were
event
you close
in my
to
life.
Her personally?
Yeah, I was very close to her and her partner, Elsa, who didn't have any other family but my family, as she was an orphan. And their lives and their sort of lifelong closetedness and how that affected me was pretty profound. You know, really, there was a closeting for survival that psychologically never really ended. Mm-hmm. So that was very shaping. And then in Madison, I think, you know, I spent a good amount of time not being out because it felt like there was a lot of other things on the table with my family.
Did you have a large family? Or?
Yes, I do have a large family. My family had a very, we have a lot of doors but no walls sort of policy. Like, you had to come in the door, but the sense of what a nuclear family was, like in a lot of immigrant families, was very different from other people in the community. So my Polish grandfather lived with us through large chunks of my life primarily, and who we called my baby auntie, was 18 when I was born, she and her partner lived with us for most of my growing up. So we never really had just a few of us. My mom was involved in building a lot of solidarity with communities of color around prison issues. I don't know if folks know this, but the disproportionate minority confinement in Wisconsin is actually the worst in the country. So there's really intense racism in the prison systems. And so when I was a teenager, my mom developed a fairly close relationship with a Tibetan family. And my brother's mom, Tsering, sort of asked my mom if she would take her son for a while. So, you know, I stress it's very different from your kind of average adoption. It was very much in community, again, there's doors but no walls kind of philosophy. So Tenzin's, my brother's incarceration and life and journey in and out with the prison system and probation was very shaping for my other sibling and our life as a family, and, you know, particularly around radicalizing us as kids and as teenagers, as well as the kind of relationship to violence, you know, that we had. We had a lot of sort of gang violence. We were often the family in the neighborhood that, you know, we got the cops called on us a lot.
Was this a multicultural environment, or was it predominantly
white? Predominantly white. Madison's predominantly white and pretty segregated. And the neighborhood I was born in, the neighborhood that I grew up in, is now fairly gentrified, but was working class white folks primarily when I was a kid. And then as my parents had a little bit more money, we moved to this more middle-class neighborhood that was white. The thing about that neighborhood was that most of the people had these big houses, and they had two or three people living in them. And, you know, we often had more like seven or eight people living. You know, there'd be like a broken car in front of the house. One time I remember the neighbors asking my mom, like, how many kids do you have, actually? Because there was always young people in and out. And, you know, we had a rule, like, we never opened the door for the police. You know, it's very specific sort of rules about how our house was run as a more, I wouldn't even say radical in an intellectual way. I just, on a day-to-day sort of street level. You know, I remember my mom going out when my brother was in a particular disagreement with some other local gang members, and going out in her nightgown in the middle of the night when they were sitting out in their cars with baseball bats, and her just saying, "You don't want to do this. Like, go home. I know your mom." You know, very, my mom's a very radical but very humble person, you know. So, you know, those were the kinds of shaping experiences, particularly when I was in high school and then later when I went away to college, that were really pretty formative. You know, there was a lot of sort of, which side are you on? Sort of the old Union song was very, it was very much the culture of my family, like thinking about, you know, that what was important was not just what people said, but what they did, not just what they said they believed, but you had to really pay attention to what people were willing to struggle for. So that's the climate of my family, which I think then influenced how they dealt with me coming out, which I think was a pretty honest process. Where, you know, we really loved each other enough to tell the truth about things. So there have been times over the years where, you know, I really, we have stayed close because we've been willing to be honest. And when they've had fears or questions, they've been honest. And when I feel like they haven't seen certain things because they're straight and they don't necessarily understand a lot of the dynamics of, you know, what our lives are like as LGBTQ people, lesbian, gay, bi, and trans, you know, they've really... We've stayed and engaged with each other, which has kept us close.
Was your family religious at all?
Yes, they are. My father's a Christian, and my mother, I would say, at this point, is more unspecified. On my mom's side, our descent is Eastern European, pagan, very traditional. People that hasn't been, you know, something that we're particularly public about. It's been kind of private. It's, you know, not that usual that people would have that much connection to that. My great grandmother was a healer on the Polish side and really got in a lot of trouble. Some people even rumored potentially was at risk of being burned at the stake. She was, which it was very late in history for that to happen. I don't really know historically how accurate that was, but I do know that, like many unpopular healers, she was focused on midwifery, on herbal abortions, on a lot of gynecological work, which has tended to make men in poor communities very angry because it's about reproductive control, as well as traditional religious beliefs that support the feminine, support ideas of interconnection, don't support Christianity and those kinds of ideology. So there's a long tradition of that in our family that mostly was not talked about, but is still definitely present. I would say that, you know, my family is very spiritual, very religious, not necessarily always Christian, but my parents do continue to have a very spiritual life. In fact, you know, this past weekend we were at dinner, and you know, my parents had this very moving grace where they talked about you know, looking over the protesters and the kind of fears that a lot of people involved in the protests in Madison this weekend have about their own families and their lives. So definitely we've always seen activism as connected to our spirituality, that those things are connected as well.
Would you say that there was a moral aspect of either the religion or spirituality that influenced you in any way?
Absolutely. I think particularly in pagan traditions, the moral aspect of a lot of those traditions, you know, are about a kind of reverence for the living world, and more about consequence than they are about sin. Mm-hmm. Less about guilt and punitive ideas, but I think the moral understanding is really about what it means to be accountable for your time here, what it means to be accountable for interdependence between different beings, and you know, and then I think, you know, spiritual religious leaders were held up as really important. We learned a lot about Gandhi. We learned a lot about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
And that was in your family?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, we were also very involved in political processes. We had good friends who were among a certain group of white feminist legislators, assemblywomen, and people in Wisconsin who were, you know, a good friend of my mom's was Becky Young, who's since passed from cancer. But she was one of the people that year after year said there must be a bus system, there must be public transportation. And I remember campaigning for her when I was a little girl. You know, I remember going door to door, and I remember being explained to me very clearly why it was important, as well as just a sense of curiosity. You know, other members of my family complain that, you know, when we were, from the time we were very little, we were always asked what we thought about things. We were asked what our opinion was. We were told about issues going on in the world. My dad tells a story about me coming home and telling him about apartheid in South Africa, and him playing like he didn't know, so that I would like explain it more. You know, he'd be like, "Dad, do you know about what's going on?" And he was like, "No, really, tell me more." You know, so there was a very there's a very political and spiritual leaning to sort of the culture of the family. I think another thing that was very impactful was my aunt, who lived with us growing up, was very involved in this practice that then became more normal around people with disabilities and integration with communities they were interested in. So one example was in Madison, in the working class community, there's a big commitment to ice fishing, which to North Carolinians is like so bizarre. I mean, basically you sit in tents on the ice. And one of the principle behind this work she was doing was people with disabilities have a right to access. So if they're interested in something in community, a bridge ally can help connect them with that. So she was working with a young man who had disabilities but really wanted to be an ice fisherman. So she went out every day for like an entire winter to help him build connections with this ice fisherman community. And she had these really bad chilblains that she would get on her feet. And she would come home and complain about them and take them off because it really hurt her feet. It's really cold out there. And I think things like that, when you think about, you know, at this point in my life, when I think about, you know, children and my role in different children's lives, it's so much about what you show them and what you do with them and not about what you say. Or about how you explain what you're doing. So being with my niece this weekend, who's 10, I really thought a lot about those same questions of, showing her that experience, talking about why it's important. She's a small child who's white and working class with a disability, and her knowing that I was there, because her schools are at risk, and that I care enough to be there. Sometimes, you don't have to like process it to death with little kids. They really get it. So I think about, experiences like that. I think about, other people in the working class neighborhood that were in our lives who would come to the kitchen table at 9, 10 at night. My folks would loan them money, sit around, chat about their lives. That was a normal thing in our family.
And what type of education did your parents have?
Both of my parents, I believe, were the first to go to college. My mom had a sister who also was in college, but I think my mom was the first, or else they were neck to neck. And on my dad's side, definitely. My dad grew up in Maine, and his family was very working class, came from working on the railroad, and his dad worked at a plant. And so my dad would pick potatoes in the field on the off season. And one year he was in this little school, and he was very smart and got recruited to go to a private prep school. So he talks about his experience of being a scholarship kid. And at that time, around class divisions, they still had that at lunchtime, the students who were poor actually served lunch to the other students, So sort of the class implications of what it took to get ahead was a lot. And then he did his undergrad at Dartmouth, and then he was in Harvard Business School, like in his first year, and his life kind of fell apart and was completely transformed. His dad, who was the closest person to him, my grandfather, died, and he realized he wanted to do something more meaningful with his life. He had had two marriages that ended, and the feminist movement was getting going, and he just had this major turn of heart. He realized that what he wanted was a feminist relationship, and what he wanted was for his life to be meaningful, and that he wanted to be a spiritual person. And so he had this really huge life transformation that ended up with him meeting my mom, who was already involved in the feminist movement and thought he was kind of a dork. He was preppy and his life was a mess, and he'd been married twice before. And she knew, exactly what her life was about. And had put herself through school and stuff. But they ended up being a really great match. They're still together and very very fond of each other, I think. And she became ended up becoming a lawyer, but always worked as a state employee, so she was still part of a public employees union, and she was a public defender, mostly for kids, for a lot of years.
So you mentioned a little bit about your sort of coming awareness of your sexuality. Could you tell me more about like when you realized you were whatever you want to define yourself as? And what was that process like coming out?
I was probably about 13 when I started, experimenting sexually with other women, and I was in a very naive and young kind of way. And it really took me till I was 18 to come out to myself. I was in a lot of denial, and one of my closest friends, who's still my good friend, when I was about 15, sat me down and really said, you've had a, you really have this real interest in women, which you don't identify as bisexual. Are you even open? You might want to think about it. And I said, absolutely not. I'm just experimenting. And when I was 18, I fell in love with a woman for the first time, and that prompted me to come out to my family. My reflection later was, the kind of empathy that that kind of dynamic gives to the rest of the community, because the things that we ask about ourselves when we are closeted to ourselves, we ask ourselves, like I did, when I was 18, maybe I'm just inherently not a trustworthy person. Maybe I'm just not a self-aware person. How could I have not known this about myself? How could I not have admitted this to myself? I shouldn't trust myself, And it really wasn't until I understood systems of oppression and homophobia and the intense pressure to lie to ourselves, and the kind of way that self-closeting makes us liars, and then how badly we feel about ourselves, that I was able to support other young people in that journey, and when they did come out, to not to be on a process to learn to trust yourself again, because it's really very easy. I mean, my family, you know, I mean, it pained them that it took me so long to come to that, because you know, they thought of themselves as open, you know, and you know, overall, I think they were. They had their struggles, but they really are very loving and positive. So, you know, it's quite a process, I think.
And when you were younger, did you have friends or people that you knew that were lesbian or gay?
Yes, we did. Several. Most of them were white people, and most of them, a lot of the people of color in our lives were straight, and a lot of the white people were gay, which was confusing given, you know, particularly how, even as white people, in my teen years, an important thing to add is that there was a lot of this sort of white middle class folks that really didn't know how to handle what was happening in my family. And there were several people of color that really did stay by our side, in particular, Miss Renee Savannah, who's one of my mom's closest friends, who's the only African American public defender in Madison for a long time, an amazing woman, and she has meant a great deal to my family. So, you know, that was an interesting dynamic. But we did have several friends and several people that my family worked with, but also who we knew socially, and my parents were very accepting. In fact, one couple that we grew up with, a straight couple who had kids, the wife left the husband and became a lesbian, and I remember us talking about that openly and it being okay, you know, with my parents.
So could you tell me a little bit about your experiences in college? Were you involved in any activism at that point?
College, I went to a white liberal arts college that's really focused on organizing. It's called Antioch College in Ohio. It's since closed, which is its own interesting story. You know, it was a very interesting time for me. The really positive side of it was that Antioch's a work study school, so you actually go out and work organizing jobs. So I was able to have short internships in a lot of different organizing areas, and I was building my understanding of what community organizing is. So, you know, I worked as a researcher around sexual assault prevention. I worked on a women's farm. I worked here in North Carolina for Democracy South, learning about rural organizing and doing campaign finance reform work. You know, and I had several jobs. It was an interesting place for me because the struggles in my family, I was worried for people's daily safety, you know, at home. I think oftentimes there's a class disconnect for those of us who are, you know, working class or class mobile. My family was more middle class at that time, but still struggling with gang violence, daily stresses, and I often, you know, wanted to drop out and come home. And a lot of what got me through it was I had a little sign over my bed that said, Lynn and Evelyn, those are my parents' names. Lynn and Evelyn, you know, worked for 10 years so that you could be here. Like, you know, you need to do your best. And I got all A's or A equivalents. I think I got one C in college, which is very different from in high school where I was not determined. You know, I got a D in German, and German is my mother's first language. Like, to tell you, you know, I would get kicked out of class because I thought I shouldn't need to have a bathroom pass. I thought that was ridiculous. Yeah, I was very, you know, I was definitely a different person in high school.
Did you have trouble fitting in socially?
I had my social crew, and we were seen as lesbians, I think, because we were budding feminists. In fact, most of us weren't, but we were seen that way because we were not very interested in, you know, cheerleading or conforming. And actually got my first taste of organizing from a young organizer of color, Pabitra Benjamin, who made me go to meetings. You know, she would just force me to go. You know, we had a lot of interesting experiences. I remember
was this in high school?
This was in high school. So that, you know, I was already kind of interested. I mean, my whole life had sort of led in this direction. But I think that, you know, I think it was a really formative time. I think I always fit in socially in a certain way. I did not like the kind of negativity and hate. I hated the racial segregation of our school. I hated that most of the working class students of color spent most of the time in the basement in the mechanic shops, and the professors' kids were on the fourth floor in these nice classrooms with all these windows. You know, meanwhile, I took advantage of those classes. You know, I took literature classes and things in high school that really were very shaping. But by the time I got to college, you know, I was very committed to my grades. I was also very committed to beer. You know? So I would, like, you know, party, and then I would get up and be the first person at the library when it opened, you know. I always really pushed myself to do well.
And what did you study?
I studied communications and women's studies. But it was very, I picked those because I felt that at that time the women's studies department there was more rigorous than almost any other program at the school. And really combined a lot of sociology, anthropology. Plus, I got to be out in the field, just listening to people, learning from people. But, you know, I felt very mixed sometimes about, you know, I remember being in a class where we were studying gang formation, and, you know, just felt like most of the other people in the class were talking about something that wasn't very real to them. So there were lots of moments where it felt hard, you know, like many young people like me and not like me. You know, I built relationship with administrative staff often, like the secretaries there, and, you know, was very interested in keeping up those relationships or knowing what was happening, you know, with the labor forces in the school. But I was happy to get out of there. And then when I left, I took a job immediately at the Highlander Center, which by far was much more transformative than any educational, quote unquote, experience I had had before, for sure.
And could you tell me what you did or how you became involved at the Highlander Center?
Mm-hmm. So when I became, when I first went to the Highlander Center, I had never been to Tennessee in my whole life. I had lived in North Carolina here in Durham before. I didn't know a lot about the South, but I had been doing work directly before with my own family and other families in Madison who were directly affected by incarceration. And there were several women of color who were very powerful mentors in that work, and all of them were directly affected in some way by that work. So we were doing a lot of work around recidivism when folks got out of prison, trying to help them not go back, and trying to organize more resourced white communities, religious communities, to support that process without controlling the primarily people of color coming out. So we were doing a lot of that kind of work. So the youth program was really growing at the time at Highlander, and they wanted somebody who knew a little bit more about prison work, which was one of the reasons that they took me.
So this was a job then?
Mm-hmm. I started as an intern, and then I was hired on the staff at one point. And so when I first got there, you know, I drove up in my car. I had all my stuff in my car. I'd never been there before. And I met who I jokingly and lovingly refer to as my boss, who was Paulina Hernandez, who was the head of the youth program at that time. She's now the co-director of Song with me. And I met her, and I met Suzanne Farr, who was currently the first woman and first queer director of the Highlander Center, also the founder of the Women's Project in 1981, one of the most pivotal Southern organizations. It was based in Little Rock, Arkansas, and a long-term crucial LGBT elder. She also wrote Homophobia, A Weapon of Sexism, which is a pivotal, you know, piece of work in the LGBT activist community. Not only that, she's by far one of the most humble and smartest and most loving people that I've ever had the gift to work with. And she's also a real hard ass. And so Suzanne specializes in young people who are really smart and probably pretty pissed and have experienced some level of oppression and have a chip on their shoulder. She's amazing. So basically what Suzanne did was she said, you know, Caitlin, you think that, you know, this is about what you can do with your life, you know. So she kind of put her hands like about maybe 6 inches apart from each other, you know, and she said, you know, I've been watching your work, and I think, you know, what you could do with your life is a lot more like this, you know. And she put her arms really wide, and she was like, but, you know, you really would have to decide, that you are willing to make that kind of commitment and work really hard and do these things. And, you know, you have to decide if you're up for it. And she also said, which I thought was very moving, you know, she said, and if you're willing to do that, I want to offer you a job today. And I said, you know, Suzanne, I don't have my diploma. You know, I haven't graduated. And she looked at me and she said, I know everything I need to know from the work that you've done here this summer. As long as I'm part of this institution, we'll never ask for a diploma to hire someone. You know, that's not what organizing is about. But, you know, if you want to be an organizer, you know, you should take this job. And if you don't want to do it or think you're up to the challenge, then, you know, you shouldn't. And it was a very formative moment for me. But a great moment when you think about what it means to challenge young people who are so angry and have been so injured and saying, you know, you can sit here and be pissed, or you can see that there's this there's this trade. You know, it's really a skill. It's really a trade. It's called community organizing, and it's about building power to change those things. So do you want your life to be about healing the trauma that has come before and about changing it, or do you want your life to be about criticizing it, you know? And I, you know, chose the former, and it's a decision I have never been sorry one day of my life that I made. I highly recommend it to anyone who has the capacity, interest, and the desire to build a different world.
So could you tell me specifically, like, what type of activities you did while you were at the Highlander? Like, were you working with young people?
Yes, I got to do so many things. You know, part of how at that time Highlander was a very innovative and exciting place to be, because we had a program called the Grassroots Think Tank Program, which was basically responding to issues that were coming up at the time. And even though I didn't work mainly on that program, it was very formative for me because I got to be the note taker in lots of meetings. I remember sitting in a meeting with folks like Trishala Deb, folks like Suzanne Farr, I'm trying to think who else was at that meeting, Andy Smith, and thinking that I would never be smart enough to talk in a meeting like that. I mean, these people, primarily women of color, were just so brilliant, and they were so humble, and their names are often not known because they're not interested in being famous. They're interested in building a different movement and a different world. And that was the first time that I ever heard anyone talk about empire or imperialism or colonialism from that perspective. And I just got to be in the room. The Highlander Center is a beautiful space that has a circle of rocking chairs. It's both the symbol of Highlander and the reality of how meetings are held. So people sit in circles for a long time and look at the mountains and have these conversations. So, you know, I got to be part of the fabric of that. I also worked on the youth program, which meant we did a program to train young people in organizing, and primarily immigrant, people of color, LGBTQ, and rural young people, bring them together to build with each other and train them in a summer program. You know, we also did a little bit of everything. I did probably the thing that changed me the most was the opportunity, the incredible opportunity to go be with Southern people where they lived and do field work. So, you know, we built with people in small towns in Mississippi where there was no McDonald's, so we would get a breakfast sandwich in the back of the gas station. You know, we built in towns where there were, I might be the only white person I'd see for a long time. You know, we built with people in Atlanta doing interesting work, having brilliant ideas. The folks at Project South, you know, were very formative in my development politically as well.
Was it a challenge for you coming from somewhere not Southern at all to like these places in the Deep South? There maybe was culture shock or different perspectives just on life or sexuality or class?
Absolutely. And I got so lucky. I mean, I got so lucky to come to the South at the age that I was, because I was 20 when I came here, and I was just such a youngin. And that's such a great time to come to the Southern organizing community, because you really get taken as their own, because you're so young, you don't know how to really do anything yet. And so they're like, oh, come here, come on, young, come on, you know, like the generosity was amazing that people were willing to share with me. And I always knew from early on that there came a point in my political life where either I had to make a commitment to the South or I needed to go, because, you know, it's a lot to invest in people and then have them not be able to take the conditions of the South and go north or go somewhere else. And when I say the conditions of the South, that's complicated. I mean, the organizing conditions are very hard, but there's also a great amount of resiliency and power. So to be a good Southern organizer, I think you have to be able to tap into that resiliency and power. You have to love the legacy and the strengths to deal with the hard stuff, particularly as an LGBTQ person. I can't speak to other experiences, but the homophobia is pretty intense. You have to be pretty in it to win it. So that it was very much mitigated by the fact that people were so willing and open to teaching me. And I always try to not come in an assuming way, you know. Built relationships, followed instructions, you know, was constructive. You know, sometimes that means you sweep the floor, you put the food out, you do whatever needs to get done until you build over time. So, you know, those were formative experiences, and also to see how within relationship, we worked with primarily straight people at that time, a lot of straight people of color, and their relationship to our queerness changed as we stayed in relationship and built with them. I remember one elder in particular who I'm very fond of, Miss Rosie in DeKalb, Mississippi, African-American elder who runs an amazing youth program with no money. I mean, you know, they're putting Cheese Whiz on Ritz crackers, you know, working with kids with disabilities that, you know, need all kinds of care that they have, you know, really can't provide, but they can have them in the program, you know. And I remember Miss Rosie, when we first met, her saying, you know, I hate the sin, but I love the sinner. You know, I don't have a problem with you. You know, it's not. We built over the years, and I remember 3 years after that day, sitting in Mississippi with, you know, the little kids in their programs on my lap, and her saying, I want you to talk to them about homophobia and why it's wrong. You know, and I just think in the South, it's very much about relationship. It's very much about not jumping to conclusions that we're not on, you know, that we're against each other. Being honest, but also making progress where we can and starting with the relationship. So that was very formative in my work at Highlander, plus just learning about the legacy of Highlander, which I would encourage anyone interested in Southern movement building to learn about the history of what's happened at Highlander from its founding in 1932, you know, throughout its history. It's a really powerful place, and they've done some amazing things there.
This may be a stupid question, but were you very aware of, like, the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the gay rights movement, like, prior to either college or your beginning your work there?
Oh, it's not a stupid question at all. I was aware of the civil rights movement. I did not know nearly as much about it as when I learned when I came to the South. I felt out of respect I needed to learn a lot and learn really fast. Women's movement, I was quite aware of second wave feminism. And when I went to college, I learned about third wave feminism, women of color led feminism. I really don't feel that I ever got enough information about the gay liberation movement when I was growing up. I am very much a zealot of young LGBT people knowing about that history. I think it's very important. And I really didn't know, you know, a lot of things. I mean, there were things I felt like I didn't really understand till the movie Milk came out. You know, there were parts of that struggle I just didn't know about, you know, and meeting elders of color who, having had the privilege to talk with people who actually were at Stonewall, has been very changing. But, you know, I don't think I knew nearly as much as I needed to. And that's why I'd encourage any straight parent on the left to teach any kid about the gay liberation movement, because you never know which one of us are LGBT and are going to really need it, you know. But I learned more as I got older.
So I think you said you were at Highlander for 3 years. Mm-hmm. What was the process of leaving there like?
Hard. Mm-hmm. It was hard.
Did you have something else you were going directly to? Or?
No, but I knew, you know, I knew I was an organizer. I knew I was a lifer, as they say sometimes by then. So I knew it would be something in organizing. Leaving Highlander was hard, but the social restrictions of the life there can be hard. The good thing is also the hard thing. I mean, I'm a big believer that with organizing, places like that offer something that's somewhat ideal, which I think organizing is a trade and a tradition, so apprenticing learns a lot better than short-term trainings. I mean, really, any organizing training that's like a week is an intro to the basic principles, but to spend 3 years really engaging in understanding what it means to do regional organizing and understanding movement thinking and movement building is pretty key, you know. And there's a way that being in that rural of a setting, you're sort of isolated with the knowledge in a particular way and with the practice. So that can be super helpful, kind of like learning a language. You know, you come back later and you have a kind of confidence that I think is really important for organizers. It also helps cut down on the ego and arrogance of organizers sometimes. Oftentimes the most arrogant organizers are the most insecure. You know, they're not very well-rounded. When you have really firm day-to-day experience where it's kind of like clockwork, like you just become a really good facilitator, you know? You don't have to feel a sense of, you don't have to feel a sense of insecurity or question. You can develop more of a sense of humor about your own strengths and weaknesses because you really know the basics pretty well. So Highlander was great for that. It's hard to date. It was hard to have a social life. You know, we stuck together. We had our close crew. You know, and throughout that whole time, I was developing a relationship with both Roberto Tijerina, who's an important song leader and board member, as well as one of the foremost interpreters, social justice interpreters in the U.S. He trains interpreters. And Paulina Hernandez, as well as other people on the staff. And Paulina and I began to form a bond that now is about an 8-year bond that was very transformative as well. We were mentored together by Suzanne, and I'm a big fan of people being mentored together. It builds a different kind of relationship. So leaving Highlander was hard, but I also knew that it was time to be somewhere else. Suzanne was no longer the director, which was helpful because that was sort of a golden era. It would have been really hard to leave Highlander when Suzanne was the director because you felt like you were in the middle of making history all the time. It sounds dramatic, but really people who know Suzanne, it's like Suzanne is always sort of seeing what's going to be happening next. So you're on the cutting edge of thinking about what's happening with the right. You're on the cutting edge of thinking about post 9/11 action, about global economies. And she can take any concept and talk to anyone about it. It's where her brilliance really comes in. And so we always felt like, you know, we'd talk about what was happening in the news and we just shift. We just do something, you know? And that was completely amazing. So it was easier. And we stayed in close relationship with Suzanne. And then when we left, I was living in my grandmother's attic, no job, but plenty of organizing. I came here to Durham. And, you know, one day I was visiting in Tennessee, and Paulina and I were sort of talking about, you know, leaving Highlander and next steps. And we were both queer people who didn't have any plan to go into a queer organization. And Suzanne said to us, you know, Song's forming this new board of all these people under 30. And we'd been doing these Beyond Marriage think tanks when we were at Highlander in collaboration with the new Song board that was being formed and talking about, you know, what's a Southern agenda for LGBT people beyond marriage. I mean, this was back in 2005, you know, so it's a common conversation now. Then it wasn't as much. You know, we were like sitting in the kitchen and Suzanne was like, you know, Song needs new staff people because Mandy Carter, who is an elder and Song founder, amazing leader, you know, she wanted to transition out. She'd been alone on the staff for a long time. You know, Suzanne was like, this board is trying to save Song. They've decided, you know, Song is worth sort of bringing into its next phase. And we need to put you all somewhere. She was like, maybe you should just like propose to them that you all, you know, I don't know, you become the co-directors or something, you do something like that. Like, maybe you should send in a proposal or something, you know. So it wasn't at all an inside job, but it was just an idea that had not occurred to us. And we were not at all sold on it because we wanted to do base building and membership building. We wanted to do organizing. She said, well, why couldn't Song be a membership organization? You know, LGBT people need a membership organizations too. They need more formal organizing. You know, why are you thinking so limited, you know? So we thought, oh, I don't know, let's think about it. And Song wasn't looking for a co-directorship. They were looking for one staff person with limited money. So we came on doing some part-time work. I was doing some part-time work helping them coordinate something. And Paulina was also a think tank or something. You know, and then we wrote a letter when they got a little bit of money to do some hire and said, you know, we want to be for the long haul in the South and we want to do it together. you know, we think the South needs strong multiracial teams, and this is what we bring to the table. And they were basically like, in one of the most, the other moving, I've sort of had these times when I've been offered jobs that are like really moving moments. I don't know if they know that like I'm a sucker for it and they know that's how they're going to get me, you know, but Robert John Inuyosa, who was the board chair at the time at Song, you know, came to us and said, "You're part of our family. You know, there's just us six board members and the two of you, and the eight of us, you know, are bringing this organization back that is so needed." You know, that's been in a pretty quiet period. And, you know, people in the South have said there's still a need for Song. There's a need for a voice and a container for LGBT Southerners who believe in justice. And we don't have a lot of money, but we're going to bet it all on you and Paulina. And you go out and see if you can raise more. You know, we had about $25,000 total left, which for an organization, considering we had bills and all kinds of stuff, is very little. They said, you know, you're part of our family. We don't want to lose you. Do you want to try? You know, should we try? And, you know, Paulina and I were very moved and accepted on the spot and spent the next 6 months, you know, working very hard to raise money. But, you know, that's an important part of the story is like, nobody in that group of eight, it was all heart. It was all passion. I mean, there were no promises that we were going to have a paycheck. There were no, you know, and we were like, we needed to have a paycheck. So, you know, there were times when we were like, well, what are we going to do if this doesn't work? I'll take a side job and we can keep doing it. You know, organizing is about what you piece together and build. There's no cushy diva, I just want to do this program work job. You know, the most exciting organizations are the ones that you have to go out there and just, you know, go for money. And I remember us going to New York to the funders wearing my little lesbian power suit, you know, and, you know, us having complete class anxiety. I mean, we're going in there and asking these people for $50,000. We've never seen that much money in our lives. We don't know anything about that much money. I mean, we were 25 years old, both of us. People asked us if we were the interns, you know. We'd have to be like, we're the co-directors, you know. They thought we were just, I mean, they were like, what? Elders told us later, like, the gossip is like, what has Song done? Who are these two young women? They're both femme. They're both immigrant. They're a multiracial team. The elders of Song are either they've lost it totally and are off the deep end, you know, or there's some reason they think we should be investing in these kids because I have no idea why they've picked these people to be in charge. And we had to build all of our relationships from scratch. And, you know, I remember the first time we got a check for $50,000, I was so terrified. My hand was just sweaty and shaking. I'd never seen that much money in my entire life. And I remember taking it straight to the bank. You know, I was just so worried, you know. And, you know, and many times on the class tip, you know, I don't have a master's degree. I don't have any advanced degrees. I don't have, you know, any sort of qualifications for the financial and fundraising aspect of Song. And, you know, so we had to build all of that, you know, and there were plenty of times where we said, you know, I'd say, you know, get back from talking to the accountant and I'd just cry and say, you know, I'm not the right person for this job, you know, and, you know, our treasurer and Paulina, you know, would say, oh no, you know, like, that's not true. We're going to figure it out. We're going to learn. And that was a really important lesson is actually you don't need to have an, you know, master's in business or even in nonprofit management. You have to have heart, you have to be willing to work hard and be willing to learn, and you have to get good support and help from accountants and bookkeepers. But, you know, you don't have to be great at math, you don't have to do any of that, but you have to really believe in good money management. You have to believe that money are the resources of people and that you've taken it in their name. And, you know, that's really how we built the financial sustainability for Song. So, you know, now if you look at our assets, you know, we have money in reserves. You know, we've built to the point where we have part-time and full-time six staff people. I mean, we're in a really different place. And that's from people who, you know, never really took a official course in financing, you know, before we, you know, were in charge, you know. But we had the things that most elders say you can't teach. You can't teach integrity. You can't teach passion, you know. You can't teach, you know, the love for the community that drives. But you can teach the other things. You know, it's nothing to freak out about.
So would you say there's a difference between political and social activism?
It's an interesting question.
Well, I was going to say, I found an interview I think you did with Frank Stasio a while ago. And you mentioned the importance of, you know, gay people being visible and just being out. Like, is that different from being, like, politically active? Or do you think it's the same thing?
Well, you know, last week I might have had a different answer. But the thing I love about being an organizer is that to do it well, you have to always be willing to take in new information. And after spending the weekend with, some people say, 50,000 people in Madison, although there's been more than 100,000 people engaged, I think I would answer slightly differently. I think that there is an importance, if you are a leader in a movement, it's important to be politically aware. So when I say politically, I mean it more in that traditional Greek sense, you know, of actual community relations and thinking about how communities are connected to each other, right? So that means having more and more, I felt the importance to have a deeper understanding of global economics, to do our work, of being rigorous, just being rigorous in our study. I think it's our responsibility. I don't think that that you need to be an organizer to be active. In fact, I think people's movements don't work that way. If you talk to the people in Madison right now, most of them would say, I'm not a leader. I'm not an organizer. I'm a person who is deeply, directly affected by this, and I'm willing to engage. And I think in the LGBT community, it's the same thing. Not everybody is going to engage the same way. I think the allegory I think of is when Vandana Shiva talks about biodiversity. You know, she's a writer who talks a lot about ecology and economics and how they're connected. And she talks about, you know, this idea in the U.S. that let's plant corn number 6, you know, this one genetically modified seed. All we need is lots and lots of this corn. We can make everything out of it. And she says, that's not the way the planet works. You know, like, that is not healthy for things. Living things don't do well with that. You know, the healthiest things that thrive, there's a lot of different kinds of plants, there's a lot of different kinds of animals, things are interacting, it's kind of messy. I actually think people's movements are very similar in a lot of ways. You know, we don't need just one Caitlin Breedlove style organizer, because then there's nowhere that meets the gaps and weaknesses, you know, and of a Caitlin Breedlove. And there's also nowhere that stimulates the strength by challenging those strengths. You know, we need people's movements. People's movements mean it's artists, it's cultural thinkers, it's partiers, you know. So in the LGBT community, we need dance troupes and drag queens and nerdy intellectuals and plumbers and, you know, we need those softball coaches. We need, you know, we need all of the strengths our communities bring. We need the nurses and the therapists, you know. We need all of these things coming together. We need farmers. You know, I that's how I think real people's movements look. And I think we really injure ourselves when we think we all have to be the same way. There's sort of this one almost soldier-like picture of what a good organizer is, right? You're a soldier. It's very macho. It's very, you know, this sort of straight masculine vision of what you do. You just grind. That's all you do in a particular way. And you're just a strategist and you base build. And as an organizer that has a tendency to be a little bit of a grinder and a little bit of a strategist and be a little bit overly absorbed in those parts, I distinctly see the need for people who have different strengths than me. So I don't know if that's the clearest answer, but I do think that that's where the social and the political meet. And when you work with communities that are as deeply socially isolated as the LGBT community, as that have experienced such a war on our connection to ourselves as spiritual people, to our connection to ourselves as social people in our families and our communities, being put out of religious institutions, we have to work against the isolation we feel. So part of our work always has to be social, because we deeply, deeply need each other. So I think those things come together. I'm not much of a purist about that, and I'm not much for holding a litmus test to people before they get in the room. Like,
would you say that the LGBT community is divided or compartmentalized? Like, everyone has their own, you know, like the African Americans or the, you know, whatever specific groups. Like, is it hard to create unity within the community as a whole?
I would say the left overall, definitely. You know, I see that in the overall left. You know, we have our people working on unions, we have our LGBT rights folks, we have our environmental justice. I think that is true. I think it's also true within our community in a particular way. I think that part of it is because those of us as white LGBT people maybe haven't dealt with some of our own racism. I've seen that be a huge barrier. I also think that, frankly, you know, the gay marriage agenda is very important to many people of many different backgrounds. And it was an agenda that was set by a certain part of the community. And you can look at that very clearly. I mean, the biggest foundations that fund this work, fund to the biggest organizations, they have pushed this agenda as a single issue agenda. And I think it's deeply injured our unity, not because it's not an important issue, but because it impacts relatively few people in our community compared to some of the other issues we could work on. So SONG is constantly surveying members. Right now we have big surveys running in Virginia and North Carolina, and in South Carolina and Alabama. We just did an overall Southern trans and gender nonconforming people survey. Again and again, our communities say violence and employment and economics are like two of the most, there's a couple other important ones, but those ones are huge, you know? And there's so many things we could work on that would bring us together in a different way, because there's so much that we share, but we have to be willing to do that work. And I do think we can become divided. I think issues around religion, it's interesting, we see a lot of LGBT people, not only, but particularly in the Black communities of the South, being very focused on finding their way back to a spiritual home. So we see a real exponential growth in Black LGBT churches and LGBT-affirming churches in general. It's a very important part of our community. Another part of our community feels very, very alienated by that. So that can be, that would be one example of division, as well as a lot of us are not used to being organized. We're not used to doing what Harvey Milk did. I mean, that was, those people were organized, you know, and we have a lot of social groupings, you know, and oftentimes our young people are not taught, I think, what we need to be taught. We saw a lot of funding in the 90s move to create safe space, quote unquote, for LGBTQ people. Now, I'm not saying that's not important, but if you show young people a video on Tuesday and give them some pizza and tell them they're safe from 4 to 6 p.m., that's a positive thing. But it's not the same as teaching them about the history of our movements and what organizing is, so they can work on not only being safe every single day of the week because they know how to build power and protect themselves, but also on how to actually transform what has so injured their lives. That's how you build real power. You know, it's the basic adage of organizing. You know, you can go give somebody a fish for a day, or you teach them to fish, right? And those are the, that's the basic thing, I think, of what has caused a lot of our division has been, we need to recognize that. We need to see our organizations and our community is not about what services can be provided. What social services, I mean, like, you know, what social opportunities or particular services. Services are important, but it's also about what we, what we're willing to give. And as we come up and maybe move those of us with more privilege into places where we can, you know, lead a life where we can have the access to move to a town like Durham, where there is a lot of our community represented. We can go to social places. We can make a lot of choices. Young people who are coming up now don't get to make those same choices in small towns in the South. And we need to see ourselves as a community, as a fabric, and how do we take care of them? That actually, I think, will heal all of us across generation when we see ourselves with more fabric. It's good for all of us, I think, to see ourselves connected in some way. At least that's my experience with our membership.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about your experiences with homophobia in the South. I know there's one particular instance, the Cameron Village thing, that got a lot of media attention. I don't know if you want to talk about that or not, but especially with your work in rural areas and maybe, you know, lower socioeconomic groups or people that aren't highly educated, have you noticed, like, is there a difference between the people in the rural areas and people in Durham as far as homophobia?
Absolutely, yes. I think that we're facing a situation in this country, in the LGBT community, where if you are not homeless, if you're not that poor, you know, there's kind of like 10 cities where, frankly, you're living in a bubble, and then there's the rest of the country. So it's San Francisco and New York, you know, it's the big ones. And then on a smaller level, the Atlantas, the Durhams, you know, these cities, the whole dynamic is really different. Now, of course, we see that homophobia can happen. I mean, the Cameron Village incident, which we could talk a little bit about, happened in Raleigh, which was very shocking to both my girlfriend and I, who, my girlfriend primarily resides in Goldsboro, which is an hour and 15 minutes from Durham, but could be it's light years away, as far as I'm concerned. What we see is that in rural communities, people are living a completely different reality. So I'd like to use, you know, two towns as an example. One is Oxford, North Carolina, which is about 30 minutes north of Durham. It's also where the famous Blood Done Signed My Name book was written about the racist murder that happened in 1970 of a black man by two grown white men that there was a lot of media around. But, you know, you go to Oxford and, you know, our members there, no one is out. I mean, they don't know anyone that is out. I feel like we know the only two or three people that are out. It's also characterized by incredible economic depression, that kind of small, rural, southern town, you know, where there's still like a old storefronts when you go downtown and there's not a lot of restaurants, it's just chains and, you know. So there's the sort of feel of the town. And then, you know, people are just completely unwilling to be out because people will say, you know, the school administrators in Oxford will say there are no gay people that live in Oxford, North Carolina. You think of another town that's very similar, Goldsboro, where I spend a lot of time, you know, where my girlfriend is probably one of the only semi-out people. And she is not even, you know, totally out because there's no space to come out to. You know, the older ladies at the library, they all know, you know, and are very proud of us about the Cameron Village stuff. So you see places like libraries as open spaces. But who else are you going to come out to? I mean, there's no progressive or even kind of liberal sort of community space there. There's very few organizations. You know, we have our friends in the community. The only other LGBT people we know there are closeted, so we don't work not to out them. I mean, the whole dynamic is very different. My girlfriend described seeing a transgender woman, because of course, trans people who don't pass don't have an option to not be out. A person of color walking past a mechanics building, like a garage, and holding her hand to her face, you know, so that they wouldn't look at her face. You know, her literally sort of hiding herself to walk down the street. And I think that is such an image, this African-American transgender woman, you know, literally hiding her face when she's, you know, on the street. That's what it looks like in small towns, you know. And also the sense of community is very underground. So we go to Target and one of my, you know, there's these gay people that work at Target. And, you know, they'll just chat with it. You know, like, we'll just be like, they'll be like, oh, hi. You know, I'm like, oh, hi. You know, we talk to each other. There's lots of LGBT people of color there. But there's no gay bar. There's no anything. There's no group. So it is. It's completely different. And it's completely different what people go through emotionally when they're living in those spaces. Alienating? It's deeply alienating. It's deeply isolating. It's very hard. It's very hard when you have children. You know, it's very hard to think about how to protect them. And, you know, they feel the need for their own safety to, you know, be dishonest about their own little lives. And that's very hard. And you see them work through that and struggle with that. It's very difficult. And I think it's very different. And at the same time, I think homophobia is everywhere, as we've seen in Raleigh, you know, sometimes the places you least expect it. And I think it's part of why we have such a responsibility to those of us who are in positions to push back in powerful ways, and who have the skills and access to resources to do that, to really do that, which was part of what we did in the incident of Cameron Village, of being asked to leave for being out and affectionate as a couple.
And as a result of that, I think it got a lot of media exposure, you know, locally and nationally also. Mm-hmm. What were you pleased, or how did you feel about how the situation was portrayed in the media? Did it bring attention to your movement or your organization in a good way? Did you have a backlash?
Many things happened that were really interesting. I think one of the most interesting things that happened was learning about what media sources told what. Basically, what story got told and what didn't compared to what I said. Because a lot of what I said was very consistent and there were lots of things that they didn't say. And it's a lesson to always ask people, you know, what they actually said as opposed to what was reported. I was happy that it got as much attention as it did. I wish that we lived in a country where people were really allowed to tell their stories in a more open way, because part of the story that we were trying so hard to tell was about what it means to have oppressed people not have access to public space. So there was one point where nationally they did report me saying it's a culture of racism and it's a culture of homophobia. Joy Behar did actually run that, but that was partially because it was live. So there's something about being live, you can kind of be a little AWOL, which I think is a good thing. But a lot of times the story was framed around, you know, were they actually being more scandalous than we thought? Or there wasn't as much, you know, they're interested in stories of individuals, just the account of what happened. They're not interested as much in ramifications. So, you know, there was an interesting sort of space there of trying to figure that out. But overall, I think that the most important part of that story is the story about the people power of it and the organizing. Because everything positive that happened because thousands of people called and emailed that mall. And they actually did change, you know, what they were doing. There was actual change because of that. So it really was a lot less about us in a way and more about us having access to the resources to really give people an opportunity to say, no, not in our community. This space is a public space and it belongs to the entire community, you know, and we should have access to it. Now, about the actual incident, you know, it's interesting because my girlfriend, you know, has a small daughter. And so, you know, African American living in a small town and looking out for taking care of that. So she wasn't in the media nearly as much. But I do think that, you know, we have to take into account, you know, all of the different things that could have been why there was so much negative attention towards us. One, we both look straight, potentially. We pass. You know, two, we're an interracial couple. You know, three, she has dreadlocks, which I think most people know in the South is read as an indicator of quote-unquote black, you know, militantism in some way, or being more progressive. It's seen as, you know, a political statement to wear your hair natural and wear it long and these kinds of things. I think, you know, all of those might have been potential factors. So you sort of have to look at the whole thing. I mean, it's very, because of the decisions that she and I made as a couple about what was going to be covered or not, some parts of that story were told and some weren't. But, you know, towards the end, she became more open about some of the media stuff. So, you know, in some of the print media, you see pictures of us together or, you know, that kind of stuff. But yeah, well, you know, it was a very interesting experience for me in understanding national media.
Mm-hmm. Was that your first sort of exposure to the national media?
Well, you know, I like to talk about like kind of the NPR divide. Like on the left, we usually can go as far as NPR, but we never break the NPR glass ceiling. So definitely it was my first on that level of national exposure. I've done a lot more progressive media stuff and done a little bit of stuff here and there on NPR, but it also really motivated me to learn more about media and being a media spokesperson.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel in your role as sort of a public figure? Do you feel insecure at all or ever feel like you've been targeted in any negative ways?
Definitely we got a good deal of hate mail, mostly hate blogging during that time. You know, it's interesting because being a public figure is an interesting thing. You know, I think I was raised up very much in this grassroots kind of tradition, like humble organizers don't see themselves as public figures. You know, the whole point is you shouldn't be a public figure. And as I got older and further into the work, the support of Song's community and the Song leadership really helped me realize that in some ways that's a little bit naive. You know, when you have a public life, you need to take responsibility for it, you know. So, you know, I'm not by any means a major national public figure, but I am willing to take responsibility for having a public life. And part of what that means is you take responsibility for what you say. You know, you say when your mind changed or when you were wrong. You know, you're willing to say, oh, yeah, when I gave that interview 2 years ago, you know, I didn't know what I knew now, and isn't that interesting? You know, and you also are willing to undergo criticism for what you say and the position you take. I mean, there's a lot of more mainstream or maybe further right LGBT forces that definitely, you know, it's interesting who talks to you and who doesn't talk to you. You know, if you're willing to take a stand about certain things, sometimes there's folks who just aren't that interested. You're just seen as a little too outspoken or too political. So being a public figure and a media, in the media, can also sort of hurt your, it can hurt certain aspects of your political life, but you have to just be willing. I think you have to be willing to take a stand about things. And when you're willing to do that, then, you know, it's not that big an issue. I think one important thing about being an out person, an out gay person who has a public life, is it should never be underestimated the kind of sacrifices that your family is asked to make for that. I encourage people to think about that really hard. And I also encourage people to talk with their families about that. And to be willing to make compromises if you need to, and also know where you're not willing to compromise. You know, for my family, you know, I can't say enough how grateful I am of their support, and I can't say enough to people how real their bravery is. You know, at times when they've been really worried about my safety, and they've said, you know, we still think you're doing the right thing, and you know, we prepared ourselves. You know, my dad, you know, said when the Cameron Village stuff happened, the day it happened, he was really upset, and he said, I feel a sense of anguish, you know. And I said, you know, no parent in America should have to feel that sense of anguish, you know, to know that your child is 29 years old, is a very powerful person in the world, and has to go through that kind of experience, and that you can't do anything to protect them. You're hundreds of miles away and you can't protect them. And so he feels that sense of anguish and sort of that sense of wanting to, you know, see things happen, you know, see sort of accountability happen. And at the same time, you know, he said, for several years now, you know, I've prepared myself for this is what your life is going to look like. My mom still has a lot more, you know, she just worries, you know. But I, you know, I take responsibility for my safety. Sometimes if I think it's even a little bit of overkill, I'm just careful because, you know, they asked me to, you know, and it's something that I do partially for them, you know, out of respect that leaders aren't made by ourselves. We don't exist by ourselves. We're supported by people, or we're not leaders, you know. We don't do it alone. And so sometimes you have to, you know, do things that you might not otherwise, in understanding of that.
Could you tell me how you and your partner felt during the sort of incident as it was unfolding? Were you know, taken off guard or offended or felt saddened in any way?
We were very offended. We were pretty angry when it happened. We both can tend to be a little bit loud.
Was it confrontational?
I wouldn't say it was totally confrontational. I think that we knew we were in the right, and we started to get upset, and then we started to just like take it down a notch, and we were like, okay, we're gonna deal with this, but not this way, because you know, I definitely saw as we raising our voices, particularly for Charlotte, my girlfriend is, you know, as an African American woman, you know, you start raising your voice to someone in a position of authority, and you know, that's when you get arrested. It doesn't take a lot. It doesn't take what it takes for white people to, I would have had to really be yelling and be in their face and be like out there, but I don't think it would have taken that for them to try to find a reason to arrest her. So we were very offended. We regrouped. I said something to not the first officer, but the officer, the that person's supervisor who got called, like, you know, I just hope that if you're willing to do this to us, that you know, like, that you have an experience where someone makes you and your family feel the way you did. I mean, you know, I was pretty. We were pretty pissed. You know, I said that in a very calm way. I don't think we were aggressive. Physically or anything like that, but you know, we want to set an example of like you don't get used to being treated badly, no matter how many times it happens. You know, we can't set an example for a kid, you know, like that. We can't set an example for other people around us like that. So you know, we were pretty. And as we walked away, you know, the supervisor said, you know, see, you just want people to see. And we said, yeah, you know, it's a climate where young people are ending their lives because they're gay and they don't see people who are out, and because of all of the pressure of the society. And absolutely, we want people to see, you know, and, you know, we're everywhere, you know. So and then I think through it, we felt a lot of different emotions, but mostly we felt a deep sense of connection and solidarity with each other, and that we were doing the right thing. You know, you always need to have that kind of reassurance. And having a little girl involved, you know, we talked with her, she's 9, about it. We showed her the footage, but it could have been very overwhelming for her. So we sort of had to figure out how we, you know, we didn't want it to sneak up on her. So, you know, had her, how she, you know, dealt with the news, and that it was for a while, for just a couple days, it was sort of everywhere. And that was hard. But I think we really, at every step of the way, you know, I've said this the whole time, even though I was in the media, you know, we made all the decisions together about how much media, how much not, you know, which was really good. So we stuck together on it, which I think was really important.
And have you been back to Cameron Village since then?
Yes. We, you know, we feel a little torn about it because we really like eating at the Flying Biscuit. But, you know, it's not, we're a little worn out on being there, of course. But sometimes when we're in Raleigh, we go. We, you know, have still, you know, continued to deepen some of the relationships of some of the organizations that were so supportive then. The ACLU North Carolina has been just such a good friend to us personally, and as well as North Carolina Justice Center in Raleigh.
So we're approaching an hour and a half. Do you have some more time, or do you need to be...
Oh, I have a little
more time. Okay. So I was wondering, how would you, or do you feel pressure in any way to define yourself as far as, you know, your gender, your sexuality, or your class at all? Do you feel labels are important?
I think that they are important, and the reason that I think that they are at this certain political moment in history is to help us unite, not past them, but within them. I think when we're honest about our differences, we're really able to build from a different place. And you know, I'm happy to talk about who I am. You know, I think a lot of times we're pressured to not, or like, you know, we're pressured to sort of amplify certain areas of who we are, but I think you know, I'm proud of who I am. I'm happy to talk about it openly, whether it's queerness, whether it's being white, whether it's being from an immigrant family, or from a working class family that became middle class. I think there's a story even in that. So I think it's important, and it's song, you know, we often ask people to identify themselves in the spirit of building with those most directly affected at the center. And you know, I think it can be, I think it can be divisive if we think that identity is all there is to it. You know, if it's about this romanticizing oppressed people, you know, then Condoleezza Rice wouldn't exist. You know, like, she wouldn't exist. There wouldn't be a black woman who has caused the deaths of so many people and supported the ongoing rise of a certain kind of imperial power in the U.S. Just, you know, if it was as simple as identity, she wouldn't exist as a person, right? Of course, it's about more than that. It's about consciousness. And I think our question is, when we sit in a certain place, are we willing to put ourselves out there and build, you know? And one of my experiences this weekend was talking to queer organizers about, you know, the struggle in Wisconsin and how it hasn't always been easy for them, and as queer people of color, as queer white people. And at first, it got me down a little bit, like hearing about some of the things that had happened that had been hard. But in the end, I felt like it was an amazing story of resiliency, because they were like, we are workers. This is our struggle. The Capitol is our house as much as it's anyone else's. And we are here. We are part of this fight. We are not leaving, you know. And that, I think, is incredibly moving, because you see that it's a struggle. And yet you're still moving from a place of the connections we need. I mean, we are going to have to build with other people outside of our identity if we want to have concrete wins that are going to be about preserving our basic survival economically and environmentally, right, on the planet. We have to find a way to meet each other and work with each other. I just don't think there's any other way. I don't think there's a way to not work with straight people, to not work with white people, you know, other white people besides myself, of course, to not work with middle class people. You know, we have to find a way.
Would you say that the gay and lesbian community in the Triangle area is accepting of diversity?
I think the Triangle overall, you know, there's always work to be done. I do think that there is a great amount of openness to our communities in some aspects of it. I think that there continue to be racial divides among a primary, most of the resources for our community are still controlled by white middle class folks in the Triangle. Song's one of the only organizations, and even within our membership base, it shifts at different times. Our core leadership on the regional level is majority people of color. But you know, there continue to be divides. I still think around trans communities and gender nonconforming communities, there is still a lot of day-to-day stuff that is just not acceptable that happens even in the Triangle. But I do overall think our community has worked hard to have a voice here, in a way that I think there's also a lot to be proud of, you know.
And if you could sort of give a message to anti-gay rights people, what would you want to tell them?
I think one of the most important things for them to understand is that we are your community. We're your barber. We could very possibly be your kid. We're probably one of your cousins or your aunts or your uncles. Like, we're not out there, we're in here. And I think the other message is about, you know, we've always been here in every part of the planet, every place. And the denial of that hurts all of our humanity, you know. I also think there's a lot to be said for the way that in straight culture we play a scapegoat role, you know, for all of their skeletons in the closet. Everything that's quote unquote deviant that they see about their gendered lives, their sexual lives, everything that doesn't quite fit in with that, we're expected to bear the brunt of that. And I really wish your average straight person would spend a little bit more time thinking about their sexuality and gender in a more open way and be a little less afraid. You know, I've known straight people who've done that, and it's really transformed their life, you know, to think that we're the only ones. You know, why would we be the only human beings that have gender or sexual spectrum? You know, how could that possibly only be us? I think your average straight person isn't maybe as, they might be sexually straight. I don't know if it's as, you know, concrete this or that as they think it is. You know, and I think it's important for them to think about what they're so afraid of. I think a lot of straight people are really, I mean, I think homophobia is an apt word in some ways. I think it is a phobia. I think it's a fear. They have this deep fear of what does it mean for men, quote unquote, to be more feminine? What does it mean that, you know, I think your average straight person would be blown away by how many transgender people they know that are passing every single day. You know, it's very interesting. I think if your average anti-gay person focused a little bit more on asking themselves why they're so hostile towards us, and you know, it could be a very different world with a little bit more curiosity and self-reflection and a little bit more humility, you know. I mean, I think at the end of the day, they're contributing to a much more violent world, you know. And you know, you just might, you know, considering the crossroads that our planet is at, might, you know, might make sense to just look at that a little bit.
Do you feel that religion or, you know, traditional culture in this area plays into that more so?
I think there's a role of Christian supremacy. I'm not sure if I always think it's individual churches, but I do think there's a model in the most conservative parts of Christianity that's very top down. It's very male, patriarchal controlled. It's this very, you know, particular manifestation of that faith, which I don't think reflects a lot of, for example, what we know of Jesus. There's no presentation of Jesus in anything that I've ever read that portrays him as particularly quote unquote masculine, you know. He's not portrayed as a deeply, deeply gendered individual. You know, he's not a general, he's not a warlord, he's not a in charge of anything.
He's a hippie.
He's a hippie. He hangs out with sex workers. I mean, this is who this dude is, you know. He's a very, you know, he's a confident, like he's portrayed as confident in the Bible, right? But he's not portrayed as hostile or as violent or as macho in any way. So it's very interesting that you have, you know, that in fact the church produces folks with this kinds of very, it's this or it's that. And I also think that the aspect of Christianity where everything is focused on what happens in heaven, what happens later, induces this sense of a lack of accountability for what happens now. So you can like stone to death your neighbors now because it doesn't matter because you're doing the right thing later. I mean, I think that in terms of contrasting different faiths, that the focus on what you do now is an important part of most faiths, I think. I think it's important to be accountable for what you do now. And I think that can contribute some to people's homophobia. Definitely the church has exacerbated and pulled out and over-accentuated the scripture about homosexuality to a great degree. I don't know. That's what I think.
And how do you balance the need for optimism with realism as far as like the social political situation now for gay people?
These are such great questions.
Thank you.
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. Because as a leader, if you're fakely optimistic, people know. Mm-hmm. It feels cardboard. It feels like cardboard. However, optimism is a responsibility. You know, Cornel West says, I'm a prisoner of hope. And that's how I feel about leadership. I'm an eternal prisoner of hope. I am, and I'm fine with that. You know, I'm happily contained by that. You know, I'm not, I think that our responsibility is to galvanize. We can be honest and we can tell the truth, and we can tell the truth about resiliency. It doesn't always have to be about just what's negative. It has to, there's always stories of survival in everything we're doing. And not just surviving, but thriving. So I think we have to, there is a great deal of realism we have to face. We have to be willing to say that we see the pain. You know, if you're a leader in the LGBT community, you have to be willing to get down in the trenches and talk with people about suicide, about violence, about hate crimes, about the level of isolation they feel in their lives. You have to be willing to listen to it. You have to be willing to affirm it, that it's real. And then you have to be able to provide some real support. You can't leave them in that place, because otherwise it doesn't make sense to be organizing. And we know hope is an essential component of organizing and change. If we don't think anything is possible, nothing really will be, right? And at the same time, the global conditions, as you mentioned, that we're facing are incredibly serious. And we need to find ways to explain that big picture in very concrete ways that people actually feel like, I can do something about this piece of it. I understand how it's connected to the big picture, and I can move on it. But I do think a resiliency-based attitude as an organizer is essential. And that means you also got to take care of your community, take care of yourself, quote unquote. That's become it's sort of a dangerous phrase in organizing circles, because it can end up with this just very sort of self-deluded self-care plan. But in actuality, part of how I take care of myself is I read stories of other organizers. I read about what's happening in the world. Sometimes it depresses me, and then I read about resistance movements, you know, and I try to understand what other folks are doing. So there's a lot of different ways to do that. And then I spread that news around.
What's the most challenging thing you've ever had to face in your role as an activist? The most difficult situation?
Oh, that's an interesting question. There have been some really hard ones. I think one of the hardest things, say that I think that I've faced a lot of situations that a lot of other people would say that should be the hardest one. You know, external pressures, hate mail, threats, all this kind of stuff, right? In actuality, when you build a very tight internal team, both sociological studies show this and just organizing practice shows this, when you have a really solid team of people, it's not that hard to be brave, because you're surrounded by brave people and you feel like they have your back, you know? And that's how I felt, you know? I remember saying that to Song's co-director Paulina, her youngest brother, who we both were very active in raising. He's 19 now, and I remember him saying, how do you be courageous? You know, how do you be brave? And I was sitting next to Paulina, we were having brunch, and I said, you know, your sister is one of the bravest people I've ever known, and it's really not hard. to be brave when I'm around her every single day, you know? And it's just not. It's not. You prepare yourself, you make certain calculated risks, and then you put them behind you. You knew it was what you had to do, and you just do it. And then you take the next step, and you figure, and you've prepared yourself for what the consequences of certain actions might be. And it's not as easy as that. It's an emotional process, but you know, you find a way. I think what's really hard is if something really hard happens inside that team. You know, if there are times when people feel really betrayed, or someone does betray someone else, or not in a dramatic sense, but in a really deep, profound, if there's honesty issues, if there's, you know, and once or twice, not that often, you know, we've been very fortunate, that kind of thing has happened inside of our teams, and that's very hard, because it really gets you at your core. I do think that that is true, and then I also think on the day-to-day, you know, being out is just, it stays hard. I mean, it's a myth that it gets easier, you know, and trying to balance how you have a personal life and how you take care of the fact that you're deeply impacted by everything that every other LGBT person is, you know, in different ways, in your own way, but that's hard, you know, and it can be hard to continue, to just continue to keep up what it means on the personal end. I mean, I think the honest thing is, you know, organizing is definitely the best thing. It's the thing I'm here to do, you know. And you have to make a lot of sacrifices. And whenever young people ask me about getting into that life, I always talk about that openly too, you know. And you have to, it's something that you have to be willing to give with both hands open, you know. So I think about, for the past 8 years, probably the longest I've ever been on in one space without having to get in the car and go somewhere is 3 weeks. You know, that's probably the longest. And I gave that, there's not one day of that I resent or I regret. You know, because I gave it with both hands open. Now, if I would have given it with one hand closed, I probably would resent it, you know? So you got to think about that carefully, because that can be very challenging. And it's not a life that's, it's not particularly easy. You have to figure out a way to make it work, you know? Keep other good people around you who are in it as well. It makes a big difference, I think.
And what's the most rewarding experience you've ever had, or one of the most?
Oh, that's an even harder question, which I think is a good, I think that's a good thing, because there's so many to choose from. I mean, I definitely think on a personal tip, the probably one of the most rewarding experiences that I've had is not even one particular incident, but sort of a gradual thing, to be at the point now where we have enough resources that we can provide jobs at Song for really, really talented, promising young organizers of color who are LGBT, and to be able to support their development and see them do this amazing work and help that make that happen has been, in the past couple of years, one of the most rewarding things. And then I think overall, just to you know, you can have one single experience, but since movements are so much broader, you know, all of the times that young people have come to me and said, not because of your work individually, Caitlin, but because of Song, like, my life has been more possible. You know, there's things that I didn't think I could do, that I didn't think were going to be possible. You know, I felt so alone, and I feel like there's a voice that fights for me. You know, you can't ever hear that enough. It never gets old. You're never less riveted with that individual young person, often young person, but not always, person's story, you know, their truth. And, you know, I think that those moments where we've really been able to represent the best parts of our traditions. Although I do have to say, there's one moment that is particularly satisfying, in terms of satisfying. So Suzanne was a founder of Song. And a couple years ago, we had Song's 15th anniversary. And we had it at the W.D. Hill Community Center. It was one of the sites, which is a mostly Black community center here. And we were inside, and there were tons of people there, and it had been so successful and great. We had a bunch of elders there in the big gym. People were drumming. And Suzanne left the room, and I followed her out, and she told me she was leaving early. And I was sort of alarmed. And I said, well, why are you leaving early? You know? And she said, you know, go get Paulina, I'll tell you why. So Paulina came and she said, I'm leaving early because you don't need me here. You know, she was like, I'm going to go back and work on my garden because you don't need me here anymore. Like, this part of our relationship where I mentored you is over. Now we're peers, you know. And to think, I mean, I get emotional even thinking about it because I think about the incredible sacrifice that she's made in her life. She was born in 1939 for the movement, just her endless commitment and everything she's given. And I know how high her standards are because she trained me, you know. Remember lots of staff meetings where she just said, you know, that's not good, you know, it's not good enough. Or you're proud of yourself because you did these 5 things. Why didn't you do these other 15 things, you know? You're smart enough to have thought of that by yourself, you know? And so that was really meaningful, mostly because, I mean, I felt good about Paulina and I, but what I felt really good about is carrying on that legacy. That's, I think that's very, very important, especially as, you know, these LGBT elders that built much more space for us. So then if we're moving around in more space, we have more space, you know, more space in our lives and our possibilities, in the culture, in our public lives, in terms of economics. What do we do with that space? You know, that it was this small when we came into it, you know, it was rather small, and then it's bigger because of what they did. And so how are we making that even bigger for young people? So definitely there's few things I feel as proud of as carrying on the legacy and tradition of folks like Suzanne in the South, and all the other thousands of people who've done work like her who have not been as recognized.
And just one last question. What are your hopes for the future?
I have a great deal of hope about building a broad-based movement for justice. Again, you know, last week it might have been a different answer. This week I'm incredibly hopeful about what we can do. If we look at what's happening right now around mass mobilization of working people, I think that we're facing a time in the future where the fight will become clear. That to me, the biggest fight is that the wealthiest 5% of this planet is consolidating the air, the water, the resources, and the land, and trying to take it from the hands of everybody else. And so in my mind, there is one fight that is the most important fight. And because it's the fight that decides all the other fights. It really is almost like a Lord of the Rings type fight to me. Not to be conspiratorial, but it really is very, you know, like the one controlling the many. And I feel very hopeful that people in this country are taking the leadership of people around this planet, for example, Egypt, who are already saying this is the fight. There's a reason that teenagers in Egypt are calling in pizza for protesters in Madison and getting them taken to the Capitol. It's because they are saying, maybe you don't totally see it the way we see it, but you're entering the same fight. And that struggle is our legacy to our kids. Whether we win or lose that struggle determines, you know, what happens for the future. So that's the big picture. My hope is that we will be willing to find a way to unite our forces for our survival. And on the smaller part of that, I very much continue to be passionate and committed to how I support LGBT people to enter that bigger fight, how to nurture and support other people to enter that fight, because I know how rewarding it can be to be part of it, and also just because I believe we have something very important to bring. I think we've been told that we don't, and I think it's a lie. I think we do. I think we've been told that we don't belong in that fight, that we're a wedge issue, and I think that's a lie. I think we have a great deal of knowledge to bring to that fight. And I also think it's not other people's fights. It's ours too. It belongs to us. Last time I checked, we still need to breathe. We still need food. We still need resources. And we still need dignity, just like every other oppressed person on the planet. So, you know, I feel very hopeful about that. And I'd say that's probably my biggest hope for the future.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. What great questions.